Junior Avonlea found it hard to settle down to humdrum existence again. To Anne in particular, things seemed fearfully flat, stale and unprofitable after a goblet of excitement that she had been sipping for weeks. Could she go back to the former quiet pleasures of those faraway days before the concert? At first, as she told Diana, she did not really think she could. "I'm positively certain, Diana, that life can never be quite the same again as it was in those olden days," she said mournfully, as if referring to a period of at least 50 years back. "Perhaps after a while I'll get used to it, but I'm afraid concerts spoil people for everyday life. I suppose that is why Marilla disposes of them. Marilla is such a sensible woman. It would be a great deal better to be sensible, but still, I don't believe I really want to be a sensible person because they are so unromantic. Miss Lynn says there is no danger of me ever being one, but you can never tell. I feel just now that I may grow up to be sensible yet, but perhaps that's only because I'm tired. I simply couldn't sleep last night for ever so long. I just lay awake and imagine the concert over and over again. That's one splendid thing about such affairs. It's so lovely to look back on them." Eventually, however, Avonlea School slipped back into its old groove and took up its old interests. To be sure, the concert left traces. Ruby Gillis and Emma White, who had quarrelled over a point of precedence in their platform seats, no longer sat at the same desk, and a promising friendship of 3 years was broken up. Josie Pye and Julia Bell did not speak for 3 months, because Josie Pye had told Bessie Wright that Julia Bell's bow when she got up to recite made her think of a chicken jerking its head, and Bessie told Julia none of the Sloanes would have any dealing with the Bells, because the Bells had declared that the Sloanes had too much to do in the programme, and the Sloanes had retorted that the Bells were not capable of doing the little they had to do properly. Finally, Charlie Sloane fought Moody Spurgeon McPherson because Moody Spurgeon had said that Anna Shirley put on airs about their recitations, and Moody Spurgeon was licked. Consequently, Moody Spurgeon's sister, Ella May, would not speak to Anna Shirley all the rest of winter, with the exception of these trifling frictions. Work in Miss Stacy's little kingdom went on with regularity and smoothness. The winter weeks slipped by. It was an unusually mild winter, with so little snow that Anne and Diana could go to school nearly every day by the way of Birch Path. On Anne's birthday, they were tripping lightly down it, keeping eyes and ears amid all their chatter. For Miss Stacy had told them that they must soon write a composition on A Winter's Walk in the Woods, and it behooved them to be observant. "Just think, Diana, I'm 13 years old today," remarked Anne in an awed voice. "I can scarcely realise that I'm in my teens. When I woke up this morning, it seemed to me that everything must be different. You've been 13 for a whole month, so I suppose it doesn't seem such a novelty to you as it does to me. It makes life seem so much more interesting. In 2 years, I'll be really grown up. It's a great comfort to think I'll be able to use big words then, without being laughed at." "Ruby Gillis says she means to have a beau as soon as she's 15, said Diana. "Ruby Gillis thinks of nothing but views," said Anne disdainfully. "She's actually delighted when no one writes her name up in a take notice, for all she pretends to be so mad. But I'm afraid that is an uncharitable speech. Miss Allen says we should never make uncharitable speeches, but they do slip out often before you think, don't they? I simply can't talk about Josie Pye without making an uncharitable speech, so I never mention her at all. You may have noticed that. I'm trying to be as much like Mrs. Allen as I possibly can, for I think she's perfect. Mrs. Allen thinks so too. Mr. Allen thinks so too. Mrs. Lynde says he just worships the ground she treads on, and she doesn't really think it right for a minister to set his affections so much on a mortal being. But then, Diana, even ministers are human and have their besetting sins just like everybody else. I had such an interesting talk with Mrs. Allen about besetting sins last Sunday afternoon. There are just a few things it's proper to talk about on Sundays, and that is one of them. My besetting sin is imagining too much and forgetting my duties. I'm striving very hard to overcome it now that I'm really 13. Perhaps I'll get on better. In former years, we'll be able to put our hair up, said Diana. Alice Bell's only 16, she's wearing hers up, but I think that's ridiculous. I shall wait until I'm 17. If I had Alice Bell's crooked nose, said Anne decidedly, I wouldn't, but there, I won't say too much what I was going to, because it is extremely uncharitable. Besides, I was comparing it with my own nose, and that's vanity. I'm afraid I think too much about my nose ever since I heard that compliment about it long ago. It really is a great comfort to me. Oh, Diana, look, there's a rabbit. That's something to remember for our woods composition. I really think the woods are just lovely in winter as in summer. They're so white and still, as if they were asleep, dreaming pretty dreams. I won't mind writing that composition when time comes, sighed Diana. I can't manage to write about the woods. But the one we're worth a hand in on Monday, it's terrible. The idea of Miss Stacy telling us to write a story of our own heads. Why, it is as easy as a wink, said Anne. It's easy for you because you have an imagination, retorted Diana. What would you do if you'd been born without one? I suppose you have your composition all done. Anne nodded, trying hard not to look virtuously complacent and failing miserably. I wrote it last Monday evening. It's called The Jealous Rival, or In Death Not Divided. I read it to Marilla, and she said it was stuff and nonsense. And I read it to Matthew, and he said it was fine. That is the kind of critic I like. It's a sad, sweet story. I just cried like a child while I was writing it. It's about two beautiful maidens called Cordelia Montmorency and Geraldine Seymour, who live in the same village and were devotedly attached to each other. Cordelia was a regal brunette with a coronet of midnight hair and dusky flashing eyes. Geraldine was a queenly blonde with hair like spun gold and velvety purple eyes. I never saw anyone with purple eyes, said Diana dubiously. Neither did I just imagined them. I wanted to slink out of the common. Geraldine had an alabaster brow, too. I found out what an alabaster brow is. This is one of the advantages of being 13. You know so much more than you did when you were only 12. Well, what became of Cordelia and Geraldine? Asked Diana, who was beginning to feel rather interested in their fate. They grew in beauty side by side until they were 16. Then Bertram de Vere came into their native village and fell in love with the fair Geraldine. He saved her life when her horse ran away with her carriage, and she fainted into his arms, and he carried her home 3 miles, because, you understand, the carriage was all smashed up. I found it rather hard to imagine a proposal, as I had no experience to go by. I asked Ruby Gillis if she knew anything about how men propose, because I thought she'd be likely to be an authority on the subject, having so many sisters married. Ruby told me she hid in a hall pantry when Malcolm Andrews proposed to her sister Susan. She said, Malcolm told Susan that his dad had given him the farm in his own name and then said, what do you say, darling pet? If we get hitched this fall? And Susan said, yes, no, I don't know, let me see. And then they were engaged, as quick as that. But I didn't think that sort of proposal was a very romantic one, so in the end I had to imagine it out as well as I could. I made it very flowery and poetical, and Bertram went on his knees. Although, Ruby Gillis says, it isn't done nowadays. Geraldine accepted him, and his speech paid long. I can tell you, I took a lot of trouble with that speech. I rewrote it 5 times, and I look upon it as my masterpiece. Bertram gave her a diamond ring and a ruby necklace, and told her they would go to Europe for a wedding tour, for he was immensely wealthy. But then, alas, shadows began to darken over their path. Cordelia was secretly in love with Bertram, and when Geraldine told her about the engagement, she was simply furious, especially when she saw the necklace and the diamond ring. All her affection for Geraldine turned to bitter hate, and she vowed that she would never marry Bertram. But she pretended to be Geraldine's friend the same as ever. One evening, they were standing on the bridge over a rushing, turbulent stream, and Cordelia, thinking they were alone, pushed Geraldine over the brink with a wild, mocking, ha ha ha. But Bertram saw it all, and once he had plunged into the current, exclaiming, I will save thee, my peerless Geraldine. But alas, he had forgotten he couldn't swim, and they were both drowned, clasped in each other's arms. Their bodies were washed ashore soon afterwards. They were buried in one grave, but their funeral was most imposing, Diana. It was so much more romantic to end a story up with a funeral than a wedding. As for Cordelia, she went insane with remorse and was shut up in a lunatic asylum. I thought that was a poetical retribution for her crime. How perfectly lovely, sighed Diana, who belonged to Matthew's school of critics. I don't see how you can make